Welcome back to the Bob Harden Show. And now here's your host, Bob Harden.
Thanks so much for joining us here on the show. We're providing you news and commentary rooted in a commitment to individual liberty, personal responsibility, limited government, and the rule of law. Coming up, we're going to be visiting with Larry Reed, President Emeritus of the Foundation for Economic Education. Right now, we have with us Mark Shulman. Mark is the founder and publisher of a terrific multimedia website. It's called HistoryCentral.com. I hope you check it out. It's great for kids of all ages, HistoryCentral.com. Mark, thank you so much for joining us here on the show.
Always a pleasure, Bob.
Thank you, Mark. Let's, of course, for our listeners' benefit, Mark is in Tel Aviv right now, and there's a lot of turmoil in Israel. So can you bring us up to date? What's going on?
Absolutely, Bob. So when we spoke last week, the Israeli parliament was about to pass the first part of this judicial overhaul, up to the last moment, there was hope that the government would compromise and it would either be delayed or wouldn't be passed, but they went ahead and passed it in the most extreme case that was there. That's created, of course, tremendous disappointment, anger, however way you want to describe it. That night, a couple hundred thousand people took the streets. Saturday night, the same thing took place. And it's created this tremendous split, and it's a split that's, like so many things that have happened in history, it's not really based on reality. So what you have is, most of the upper middle class and middle class 100% against these changes, because basically what they do is they just give additional power to the government. It eliminates part of the checks. There's no bill balances in the Israel system, but eliminates some of the checks on the government's power. And, of course, the rest of their plans are to eliminate all the rest of the checks. And then you have supporters of the plan, which break into two or three groups. There are those who come from the settlements and those places, and they want to do things that they knew the Supreme Court would not allow. Mm. There are people who it's basically, and this is where the most problematic group is, that, our team. So it's our team, so we're in favor of this legislation, and everyone who's against it are basically privileged, basically equivalent to white males. I mean, that's not the Israeli term, but that's effectively what's used. And what's happened is it's developed this ethnic aspect of it, very much so, that particularly some of the Israelis from Middle Eastern origin who make up a lot of the supporters of the Likud are up against the court because the court is white privilege. Now, it's not true. The court has a wide range of people, and the whole ethnic issue in Israel really shouldn't exist. I mean, I remember 40, 50 years ago, in the 70s, I guess that's already 50 years, basically, sociologists said it would disappear in a generation or two because of intermarriage, because one third of Israelis marry someone from Eastern or Western, they make mixed marriages, so to speak, and so in two generations, who is everybody? My wife is half-half. My daughter married someone from Morocco, Israeli from Morocco. So what are my grandchildren? It's ridiculous, but yeah. it's used as a political tool, and it creates anger and everything else relating to that, and that's very problematic. So it's divided the country very much along those lines. Where this is going to go, we don't know. Netanyahu desperately wants the power, which he hopes will keep him out of jail ultimately.
So what's interesting to me is the pressure on individual Knesset members. It must have been huge. So what you're describing is very unusual when you think about all the protests and the things that have been going on and people, quote-unquote, sticking by their guns in the Knesset.
Well, remember something. Israeli Knesset members are not responsible to anyone. And what do I mean by that? So the Israeli Knesset is made up of parties. When you go to vote in an election, you vote for a party.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a national list. It's not a regional list. So you're voting nationally. In Britain, by the way, it's a regional list. So you're voting within your region. So there is some responsibility. It's a national list. Some of the parties, the people who are run are chosen by the heads of the party. There's no elections whatsoever. In the areas where there are elections, it's basically within the party elections to represent somebody. And, of course, within the party, generally speaking, and you can look at that in the United States, too, who turns out for a primary election, the Houston. Now it's a larger number, but it's the people who are most ideologically motivated, let's put it that way. And even then, all they do is they get to choose who's on the list, and then the prime minister decides who becomes a cabinet minister. The place you are on the list doesn't even determine whether you become a cabinet minister or not. So it's a very centralized power situation. That's part of the problem. In other words, there's no independent power source in Israel. The executive and the legislative branch are basically one and the same.
Interesting. In fact, it feels like in the United States that people are not, the politicians aren't accountable to the people that elect them in so many different ways, and yet what you're describing is even worse in Israel.
Much, much worse. Remember, ultimately, U.S. congressmen and senators are ultimately responsible, particularly congressmen. So those congressmen can easily, if a district opposes, you know, whatever he decided to do and it's important enough, they'll vote him out. They can vote him out. There's no problem. He has a direct responsibility to the people in his district. Again, people, the Senate, it's a little bit less. I mean, it's to the state, but the state, of course, is more amorphous than a congressional district. And then in the United States, don't forget, you have something else that they don't have in Israel. You have state state government, which right. doesn't exist in Israel. So, you know, you're certainly your state representative. I'm sure you know who your state representative is, right? You know him personally.
Bob Rommel, absolutely. Yeah,
right.
You're absolutely right, though, because, and of course, the states have a lot of power. They're, you know, again, the petri dish for democracy in America.
Very much so. So, I mean, I think when you make the statements that American politicians and congressmen and all levels are not responsible to people, I don't think it's right, ultimately. It does mean that we don't ultimately get sometimes the decisions that we want, you or me, in any given time. But in the United States, politicians are directly elected in larger and larger groups, depending on, you know, what platform. So obviously the state representative is the smallest, right?
Yeah.
And, or, you know, probably the county commissioner is even less, but you know what I mean. They're various levels. And those people are not going to go against the will of the people if they want to be reelected. That's the reality.
Mark, we need to take a little break. Can you stick around?
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to have more here on the Bob Harden Show on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
Stay tuned for more of the Bob Harden Show here on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
You have questions about your retirement? Ameriprise Private Wealth Advisor Jason Nardella with Nardella Financial Group, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, LLC, can help. With the exclusive Confident Retirement Approach, you'll work together to develop a retirement roadmap to get you where you want to go. Call Nardella Financial Group today at 239-325-1041. That's 239-325-1041. Office is located at 9015 Stratiskell Court, Suite 103, Naples, Florida. The Confident Retirement Approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
You're a valued professional RN. There's a path that takes you to the next level. Hodges University offers an RN to BSN program that, like you, is way above average. RNs with a BSN have a faster track to pursuing leadership positions and can see faster hourly rate increases than those with an ASN. You can earn your BSN with Hodges in just 1 year. Classes are online and start in August. Scholarships are available. Become the next level nursing professional. Do more. Earn more. Be more. Visit Hodges.edu today.
Welcome back to the Bob Harden Show. And now here's your host, Bob Harden.
Thanks so much for joining us here on the show. It's brought to you in part by the Foundation for Government Accountability. They prepare elected officials to win, have winning strategies in the legislature. And you can find out more. Visit the website, thefga.org. Coming up, we're going to be visiting with Jim McTagg, former Barron's Washington Bureau Chief. Right now, we continue the conversation with Mark Shulman, the founder and publisher of HistoryCentral.com. Again, Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Will.
So, update on Ukraine. What's going on?
Okay, two things are happening. The Ukrainians seem to have broken through in a few places and are making substantial progress. It's not clear, you know, the fog of war makes it difficult to know exactly what's going on, obviously. One of the interesting things that's happening is they seem to be successfully destroying the bridges or making them impassable to Crimea.
Uh-huh.
And so the Russians are having a harder and harder time supplying their troops in Crimea. And so they're starting to really show it. And I think one of the interesting things today was the fact that Medvedev, the former president who switched back and forth with Putin, made a statement today saying that if the Ukrainians' counteroffensive is successful, we will have to use nuclear weapons.
Speaking of which, Mark, what's happened with regard to the nuclear plant that was located in
outside the Zaporizhzhia plant, I think it's called.
Right.
It's still there. It's not running, but it's connected up, so it has backup power, and so it's not in any immediate danger, but the Russians theoretically have mined it. It's a dangerous situation, but the Russians, remember, again, you know, people forget the fact, and that's also one of the reasons why the Russians are unlikely to use even tactical nukes, because remember the prevailing winds in Europe.
Yeah.
As they are in the United States, which way do they run? They run from the west to the east.
Yeah.
What's to the east of Ukraine? Russia.
Russia, yeah.
So,
go ahead, Mark.
You're much less likely to use nuclear weapons or blow up a nuclear power plant when the fallout's going to head your way.
Great point. So am I correct that the Russians changed the age for recruiting?
Right, they've increased the age in terms of people can get out of reserve duty. Look, they're scraping the bottom of the barrel here. They're doing okay. They're doing better in defense than they did in offense. But the Ukrainians are quite determined. And the Russians, you know, the Russians ended the grain deal, which is a real problem for a lot of Africa. It's a problem for Ukraine in terms of the exporting the grain, but it's a bigger problem for the recipients.
Yeah.
But then they went ahead and attacked the city of Odessa, which was a very historic city, and they attacked churches and all sorts of places. Again, what the Russians don't seem to understand is every time they do something like that, the Ukrainians are not likely to give up. They get angrier and angrier, and they're less likely to ever negotiate a settlement with them. It's, you know, counterproductive, to say the least.
So what did I read that the Saudis were trying to arrange some sort of a compromise?
It'd be some sort of a peace conference, but it's not really sure it includes both sides. It's more like, well, here's the conditions for which we could reach a peace agreement.
Yeah.
The Ukrainians, I think, are supporting their effort, but I don't think it'll go very far. I mean, yeah, Putin has to decide he's giving up, and he can't really afford to do that.
Yeah, in fact, I think I recall the column that I read that the Russians didn't even show up. Hard to negotiate a settlement with that when that happens. So let's move to what's happening in Niger. That's kind of a tragic
thing. Yeah, that's a sad point, actually. I mean, two parts to it, obviously. Number one, they had a democracy. They were elections, and everyone agrees they were fair elections. But the military decided, as has happened way too many times in Africa, that they want to take control. And so they staged a coup, ousted the president, and made some sort of stupid excuse that it's to fight terror better, or some version therein. Niger is an ally of the United States in the fight against terror, and there are some U.S. small number of U.S. troops there as well to help in the fight against terror. Now, interestingly enough, the Organization of African Unity has basically threatened to send troops into Niger and to restore the president, and have demanded that the military let him out of jail and let him resume being president. So it's interesting, and it's interesting that there's enough of enough support for democracy in Africa these days that the organization is willing to take a stand and literally threatened to go to war against these people in order to bring the president back.
Yeah, which kind of raised the question in my mind, what's happened with the UN? What is their position with regard to Ukraine, Niger, and other situations around the world?
Look, the UN has a problem in some places, particularly when there's a Russian veto involved.
Yeah.
So in terms of Ukraine, it's very hard to see what the UN can do because, you know, remember, looking back at history, the UN took the side of South Korea when North Korea invaded. And people ask, well, how did that happen? Well, it happened because the Soviets were boycotting the UN at that particular moment, so they didn't use their veto because they weren't there.
Right.
So that was like a fluke of history. The Russians, generally speaking, are creating problems these days. They refuse to renew humanitarian efforts in Syria to bring food for desperately hungry people. So they've refused that, and of course they've refused in terms of the grain shipments out of Ukraine. So the Russians try to be spoilers wherever they can, and so the UN is always limited when one of its Security Council members is basically the bad actor himself.
Exactly. I mean, there's certain irony in the fact that Russia is sitting on the Security Council and they're at war right now and aggressively attacking Ukraine.
Right. No, look, it's always been a problem. It's a problem all the way through the Cold War. The UN is most effective when it's dealing with an issue where there's consensus.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, there are those issues. And, you know, I think one issue, based on how hot this summer has been, that will be an issue that there's more consensus in the world than there ever has been, and I think we'll see more involvement of the United Nations when it comes to that. But it only works when there's consensus. When there's not consensus, the UN has a hard time acting.
Let's move to Japan and China. What are your thoughts?
Okay, so my thoughts are similar, but they're started off by the information that came from Japan. Japan lost 600,000 people, population this year.
Really?
600,000, yes.
Wow.
So that's a big number.
What is the reason? Would it be deaths or?
The age, you know, they've had a small number of children for the last 40 years.
Yeah.
And as the population ages, people die naturally, and they don't die young particularly, but they die. And when, you know, remember, if you had one child per family, two people die, and they're replaced by one, basically.
What's the population of Japan? Is it like 30 million, or?
No, it's more than that. I think it's closer to 80 million. I'm just, that's a good question. I should have known that. But I think it's, hold on.
600,000. You said 600,000, right?
Yep.
Wow, that's a big number.
According to ChatGPT, the population of Japan as of 2021 is 125 million.
Oh, it's a lot bigger than I thought.
Yeah. So, but that's still a big number.
Yeah, absolutely.
The big number, and the reason I put the two together is because China's is experiencing more or less the same thing. And, neither country has immigration. That's the other part of it. Japan is impossible to immigrate to. It's always been impossible to immigrate to. As a matter of fact, if you're not an ethnic Japanese, you cannot get citizenship. I know I had friends who were born in Japan. Their father was a trader, and, he wasn't a citizen, but he lived there all his life. The kids were born in Japan. They were never able to get citizenship. And their father originally had Iranian citizenship. And when the Shah, was ousted, he lost his Iranian citizenship and he had to leave Japan. And the kids had to leave Japan because they didn't have a foreign passport anymore.
That's interesting. And you know what? And also, it's the attempts for illegal immigration into Japan and China is conspicuously absent. There just seems to be no effort on the Department of Immigrants to go to those countries.
Well, okay, so there's no interest in going there. I mean, look, we talk about the problems of immigration in the United States all the time. Before we talk about the problems, let's celebrate the fact that everyone wants to come to America, right?
Uh-huh.
That's the starting point. They don't want to go to China. They don't want to go to Japan. They don't want to go to a lot of countries in the world, but they want to come to America. So that's a good thing in and of itself, right? Leaving aside all the problems it brings.
Right.
The United States has done well economically to a large extent because of immigration, because immigration brings two things. One, the immigrants themselves get counted, so the population doesn't go down because the birth rate of second and third generation plus Americans is dropped below two at this point. But immigrants have high birth rates.
Yeah.
So they have lots of children in the first generation, and a little less so in the second. By the third generation, they look like, you know, average American families, which is less than two.
Yeah.
So immigrants have what saved the American economy for the last 20 years.
Absolutely. The only problem we have now is we just need to make sure that it's legal immigration, not illegal.
Absolutely. But the simple way, it's really simple. I've said this before. Just increase the number of legal immigrants you give, the visas you give, and process them in the countries where people want to come.
Yeah, and to simplify and streamline the immigration process, I think there's a lot to say for that, and it's pretty archaic, the system that we have right now. Makes it difficult, and therefore you have people that come here, don't renew their visas because they're concerned they'd have to go back to their old country, and so we have a lot of illegal people here just on that basis alone.
No, absolutely. But again, you know, even the current situation, however chaotic and however problematic, it's been good for the economy, ultimately.
Yeah.
We don't have there's a low unemployment, productivity is up, and the country's growing. And part of the reason is because of immigration. That's not the whole reason, obviously.
Yeah, right.
But it's part of the reason. So we need to find a way of making, eliminating the problem of illegal immigrants, let's put it that way.
Right, which are massive. I mean, you have people who are terrorists, you have all people that are ill, you have all kinds of people coming in that we don't want here. It's probably not 5%, it's probably not 2%, but still,
it's a very small but substantial percentage. But don't forget, these people can come in as, you know, as tourists on a plane just as easily. If they're really bad people, they get here the other way.
That's true.
Think about the 9/11 bombers. They didn't have to sneak across the border. They took a first class or a tourist class ticket from Saudi Arabia or from Germany, arrived at Kennedy Airport or wherever they arrived, and here they were.
And actually went to Tampa and took flying lessons in order to crash into the building.
That's right.
Unbelievable.
So you know, we spend too much time I'm not in favor of illegal immigrants coming across the Mexican border. Don't get me wrong. But when we're worrying about terrorism, et cetera, that's not really the problem. The problem is we need to know who's here.
Yeah.
That's the basic thing. We have to know who's here, keep track of who's here, and yes, be able to find those people that are terrorists or criminals. And
right.
That's the most important thing.
Mark Shulman, again, founder and publisher of HistoryCentral.com. I hope you check it out. Mark, really appreciate your commentary here on the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Have a great week.
You say thank you so much, Mark. All right, coming up, we're going to visit with Larry Reed. He is the President Emeritus of the Foundation for Economic Education. That and more right here on The Bob Harden Show on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
Stay tuned for more of The Bob Harden Show here on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.